Hello, and welcome to 18 Groups podcast on sustainable MiFID II compliance, brought to you from our RegTech Summit in London on the 4th of October 2018. The podcast covers a panel discussion and focuses on the transparency requirements of MiFID II, data management for best execution, and optimization of data sources generated by the regulation. Listen to the podcast to find out more.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the panel, and the topic for today's discussion is towards sustainable MiFID II compliance. So we have got a great distinguished panel and business leaders, and I appreciate you all being here. And so without further ado, I shall get right into it. So let me introduce you all to all the panelists today. So from the left, we have got Nicholas Philpott, the head of market structures Standard Chartered Bank, Martin Groot, VP Product Management, Asset Control, Peter Moss, CEO, SmartStream RGU, Malavika Solanki, member of the management team, Derivatives Service Bureau, and myself, Gauri Piketua, a regulatory consultant at Grant Thornton. So let's think about MiFID II from a little bit different perspective. So let's move on to the first question that we have got from an SI regime. So I think Peter's presentation was really great. And so if we can just start with you, Peter, what are the key issues and is there a role for RegTech in helping the firms meet SI obligations?
So as I think I sort of touched on in the last presentation, I think there is a massive role. I think there are a number of firms that still need help. I think there are a number of firms who are still entering into this space. And I think the RegTech community generally ought to be paying attention and looking at ways in which they can actually sort of help. And of course, this isn't just one regulation. This isn't just one this isn't the only regime that everybody has to sort of pay attention to, right? So a lot of the RegTech firms that I've talked to actually are looking at sort of ways in which they can start to consolidate things across regulations, helping firms to actually sort of report on multiple jurisdictions without actually having to sort of implement completely different solutions in every individual case. And I think there's lots of opportunity to do that. I think we help a little bit in the reference data space, as do other firms, but the technology piece is a lot to still play out, I believe.
Thank you. Malavika?
I think Peter said it out really well during the presentation. Just to add to that, given where we sit, what we're seeing is there's a fragmentation in the needs. So you've got kind of the people that are SIs or might be SIs, whether it's tier one or specialist instrument or currency-based pieces. You've also got, we get a lot of questions from people coming in who might be customers of SIs, because what they're trying to do is understand not just what are my reference data needs, which is where we sit, but actually more broadly, is the institution that I'm going to be trading with going to remain an SI in that space? And if they are, what does that mean? So that goes back to something like people trading with perhaps an institution that might become an SI in a particular Scandinavian currency swap, for example. We get a lot of those kind of questions as well. So you touched on the ET pieces, but there's a lot going on even inside Europe. So there, from a RegTech help perspective, there's really two things in there. One is being able to understand what need you're trying to solve for, but the second piece becomes what particular strategy is that firm or that group of firms looking to solve for? Because you've got the MiFID II pieces, which is kind of immediate. You've also got a number of other data changes coming through over the next couple of years. If you look at kind of the G20 rules, if you look at a lot of those pieces. So it's also trying to understand, really, as a RegTech institution, what's the need you're trying to solve for across the board.
Fantastic. I think if we can hold to that thought, Malavika, for a moment, and we can just move on to the next question coming to you. Considering the view from a trading desk perspective and from where SI means, what are the key challenges that the compliance desks or the challenges for the compliance desk from a pre-trade perspective, from a pre-trade monitoring perspective to ensure right decisions are being made on the trading desk? If you could say something on that.
So I can start, I think, a little bit, again, just by talking about what we're hearing, given the diversity of voices, but a couple of things, and I think the white paper touched on this as well, but it's about really understanding, for me, I think if I was going to boil it down, there are really two pieces to this. One is understanding what the market structure is that you're going to be playing in and what the technology needs are to support it. The other part of it is making a determination about where, from a trading desk perspective, you want to remain an SI. And if you don't, how do you want to, do you want to disengage from servicing certain customers? And if you do, how are you going to make those decisions? So there's both a RegTech implication and a commercial implication. Just purely and simply, if you look at the simplest reporting need, from a pre-trade perspective, you've got to get your data out. The quotes, if you make something available to trade, or whether it was traded, as soon as you put those quotes out, there is a fairly time-sensitive obligation. So again, from an institution perspective, how is that going to be managed? Do you want to solve that yourself? Do you want to go to a RegTech firm? And how, you know, are you also then looking at the other obligations that might come beyond MiFID II?
Thank you very much. Nick, can I move over to you to this particular question from an extraterritorial perspective? What are the extraterritorial challenges that you, what is your opinion around that?
Well, so Standard Chartered's got some fairly significant problems when it comes to the systematic internaliser regime, because not only do we have to apply it to our UK entity, but also all the branches of that UK entity. At least that's our read of the regulations. That includes places like Singapore, slightly more esoteric places like Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Oman. And if you start applying a European regulation to some of those jurisdictions, it starts to look very strange very, very quickly. So unfortunately, from a monitoring perspective, our compliance officers really have to struggle with the fact that the regulations are not written with that sort of scenario in mind. Yep. So what they're doing is they're trying to make sure that we're adhering not necessarily to a regulation, but our house view of what that regulation means. So, and that's incredibly difficult for them. I suppose the other thing is that in our asset classes, so we're very much active in non-equities and specifically emerging market non-equities, there is very little transparency there at the moment. The transparency thresholds are very, very low, very little is illiquid. So the amount of quotes that we're making transparent is incredibly small. So if we send out no quotes in a day, we actually may be correct.
Thank you very much for that. Moving on to the next question is meeting the pre- and post-transparency requirements, reviewing ongoing data, reference data challenges. So how do you think that the RegTech firms help analyse and report? Nick, if you'd like to have your opinion on this, please.
Yeah, certainly. So SI determination, as in knowing who is what, who is an SI in what instrument, because you register, say, as an SI in derivatives, but then within sort of the whole gamut of derivatives, you could be in for interest rate swaps, but out for FX swaps, for example. So there's a great deal of granularity in terms of knowing who has the obligation, because you've got to do this in sort of in real time, frankly. Then you've got to have a rules engine, and you've got to gather that data to pump into that rules engine. So it's knowing things like what is the location of execution as opposed to booking entity. Booking entity being the thing that we traditionally tracked. Is it venue traded? Is it TOTV, UTOTV, and so on and so on and so forth. So it becomes, you know, a very, very difficult exercise to be achieved. So the reference data has got to be clean and it's got to be immediate.
Peter, do you have any thoughts on that?
To completely agree with all of that. I mean, I think the other thing I would actually sort of point out is that this point about sort of how granular you get in terms of whether an SI is actually providing services or not is actually quite extreme. We've just had to go through a process of actually mapping RTS2 down to 7 levels of granularity for some of the derivative products. And actually, it is possible at the moment for firms to opt in and opt out or become mandatory SIs in any one of those individual granular areas. So the level of detail that you get into is potentially huge. And that's all ingrained into the ESMA and European regulation. So hard to actually avoid, I think, is the bottom line. So I would stress the fact that the reference data is critical. I mean, I think you can get a lot of good reference data from the ANA DSB. I think blending, in our experience, that data with ESMA data, with GLIFE data, and then making sure that the classifications actually all make sense is where the difficult thing comes in. And sort of bringing all of those things together, I think, is a bit of an art form. But pre- and post-trade transparency is starting to happen, and I think it's starting to happen reasonably well.
Okay. Anybody else? Yeah, that's. Please go ahead.
With Peter, I mean, you need the basics also before you can do any funkier things in terms of data analysis. So I think from a regulatory perspective, I think first of all, to prepare firms to have all the contextual data so they can trade uninterruptedly and have the sort of basics information. I think a lot of the sort of early quality issues probably have been addressed. The AI took a while to sort of get going after the initial sort of waiver and the MIG codes too. So there's, I think, some basic enablers, data models and integration. And I think that integration, be it with DSB or other services, I think is getting more and more important. Right? So the market data source is moving to a lot of APIs, in ad hoc interactive data sources. When it comes to analysis, I think that is, it's not easy to make good music out of the sort of raw data, the new raw data. So
right.
I had a look at a range of, I think, RTS 27s from a number of banks and the variation in formats and how the content is split, be it over the sort of article of the legislation or the instrument or the date or the high-level instrument class is it's all over the place. So it requires some serious data wrangling, so to speak.
Thank you very much. That's it. So seeing for the next question, we are moving over to best execution. So what are the challenges that the industry is facing when it comes to best execution reporting and how well the firms are meeting the data management requirements for best execution reporting from a non-equities perspective? Nick, if you would like to place some thoughts on from your end.
Please. Sure. I mean, it's incredibly painful. Almost all of the tables are written very much from a Eurocentric and an equities agency point of view. So when you start trying to put, say, a Singaporean FX option into it, it starts to look very, very strange. Just a few simple examples. So the time snaps, 9:30, 11:30, 1:30 and 3:30 in the European afternoon. Singapore FX options aren't liquid in those time, many of those times. So a lot of the data you're presenting is going to look quite strange. Inverse rates. So, you know, you could have dollar Sing and Sing dollar. They would get the same ISIN, but one would be quoted inversely to the other. So when you start putting it to the tables, again, it starts to look quite strange. And just the sheer amount of data that you have to gather, particularly around quotes. So you have to form a house view as to what's firm, what's indicative. If you're sending out electronic stream pricing or an RFS, for example, then you've got to determine, well, which snap do I take? Is it the point at which the client hits it or the client requests it? You know, simple stuff like that. And looking at it across firms, I mean, just us alone, you're looking at something like 160 fields across about 50, 60,000 instruments. It's about 8, 9, 10 million fields. And that's just one firm. 160 SIs? So then another 200 venues, and then throw in the market makers and other liquidity providers, most of them publishing by CSV. Forget it.
You're drowning in information.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
Okay. Martin?
Yeah, second that. I think the both qualitative and quantitative burden has increased significantly. So the not only the, I guess, what you need to disclose, the due diligence and the sort of broker selection, documentation. I think to next point, I think there's a bit of myopia. Maybe not every market is like the equity market, in terms of limit order book. Maybe part of the regulation may be trying to achieve that in terms of transparency. Mm. But of course, it's not the same in terms of sort of how you come to execution.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think on the cost reporting, you can wonder something maybe making a mountain out of a molehill in some cases when all the costs are in the bit of a spread and there's a lot of additional things that need to be reported, which maybe is overkill because it's not relevant in those markets.
Mm.
Thank you. Moving over to the fourth point is the data optimization, which is the key for MiFID II and for most of the regulations. So let's talk about how are the firms exploiting the data sources created by MiFID II to generate value for the business? So I'd like to start off with Martin and then move over to Malavika.
Yeah, obviously it's maybe an opportunity. I think it's taking a step back. I guess if you take a kind view, you can say maybe that the point of regulation is not to get a specific report, but to make sure those capabilities of producing those reports are ingrained in firms. And at the same time, then once the data is out there, maybe you can do something else with it and use the sort of data that's reported by your peers or sort of take an aggregate view. And the way we look at it, we do a lot of work in the mid office and in valuation. So we look at sort of the price data, the transparency data, post-trade transparency, try to mine that for common trade book regulation, and look basically for additional sources of historical market data, be it sort of market surveillance or just purely to feed into risk measurements. So that's our perspective. There's a lot of, I would say, what I mentioned, data wrangling, and sort of cross-referencing to reconcile different product taxonomies and so on, to be done. But to the earlier point, I think all firms are looking for ways, if they face a pretty broad, comprehensive change roadmap, to try to sort of combine things, whether it's sort of market abuse and surveillance, or whether it's TRIM and FRTB, they try to combine and do the sort of same change to tick multiple boxes, if you like.
Malvika, your thoughts on this?
Again, given what we see, there seem to be really three prongs being taken. It depends really on the institution's view. So the first of the three are people who are choosing to get into the data game themselves. There are some SIs who announced this earlier this year. From what I understand, there might be others coming. So one group is actually looking to see what they can do to commercialize what they're sitting on in terms of SIs or the larger data and the larger banks. You've then got a second set that seem to be talking to us about trying to improve product coverage, on the basis that, and I think it was about 2 weeks ago, someone said to me, look, if I'm going to give you guys 70% of my book to get the ISINs anyway, what on earth am I doing, you know, wasting time on the other 30%? I may as well get efficiencies and maybe solve some other operational risk pieces along the way. So there are some firms that have that view. There are a number of conversations about whether the attribute sets are right. That's a different point, but it's there. The third set are looking more, from what we can see, seem to be looking almost forward to what else is going on in the data spectrum space. What are the other regulations coming? How do you optimize? So you've got the ISIN now. You're going to have the UPI come down. At some point, the CFI codes, which are part of EMIR Level 3, will be shifting out. So they're starting to already think about what does that look like and how do I make my data platform work, not just for what was supposed to be September of this year or March next year, but really how do I make it work or set it up to succeed with as little as future investment as possible in time for the 2020 kind of changes coming.
And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the ultimate goal here was transparency, right? So so with all of the data that is now being published, it will be possible at some point to produce a consolidated tape. And I know for a fact that Thomson Reuters and Bloomberg at least are actually looking at sort of stepping in and trying to do that. But it's not necessarily a straightforward thing to do.
Thank you very much. I just would like to pause for a moment and take some questions from the Sliders. So the first question is that there is already a suggestion that SIs are bending the rules and maybe phased out. Thoughts on that? Who would like to go first on that?
Go on, I'll take it. Well, as the only system, I think I'm the only systematic internalizer, lucky me. So I suspect this question is more directed at an equities systematic internalizer.
That's right. So
bringing together it was a network of SIs to create, effectively recreate a trading venue, something to that effect. I can speak to it from a non-equities point of view. So the rules are simply not that clear. So take, for example, distributing to equivalent clients. So upon what criteria do you base equivalence? Obviously, it has to be objective and non-discriminatory. But really, that's up to us, how we determine that. It goes into our order execution policy and our SI commercial policy. But the rules are really not that specific. So in terms of bending them, you can't bend something that isn't there. So for example, we look at the client, their domicile, their expected volumes, liquidity impact, criteria such as that, which is all measurable, demonstrable, as a way of judging who gets to see who else is quote.
Okay, taking the second question, how can we take advantage of the pre-trade transparency and when we have no consolidated tapes?
Well, yeah. So I'll take it because I think there will be one at some point, or maybe two, or maybe even more than that, right?
Yeah.
I think it's no secret that I think the APA output is not set up to make that easy at the moment, but I'm sure the APAs are going to resolve that at some point so that actually someone can pull all of this data together in a meaningful way. It will happen.
The next one is MiFID II still presents a lot of challenges, which we all know. To what extent and how will ESMA address this?
Not sure we have anybody from ESMA in the room.
You probably need someone from ESMA for this, but if you're just looking at as recently as last week, from what we saw was there was more guidance put out. So it's from what we can see just periodically, there does seem to be more guidance coming out as people go to the NCAs, and certainly when stuff comes into us, one of the things that we tend to tell people just is that it's the best thing to do is to go to your NCA and make sure that gets fed in Otherwise, things get stuck in a feedback loop purely amongst market participants, and they don't get fed up in the way they need to be.
I agree with that, because yesterday I got to see something from ESMA, like, you know, coming up with the investor protection day before yesterday. It was on the trading desk, like, you know, RTS 1 and 2. There's, like, you know, guidance coming up, like, you know, on a daily basis. So, yeah. So thank you very much on that.
One other thing. I mean, I think the other way they're addressing it, of course, is they're not, and the regulators aren't really sort of coming down hard on people yet. So I think that people are sort of still holding off while things settle down. And I think when you start to see enforcement actions coming through, it's likely to be a good indication that there's a perception that the market has stabilised, that things are working okay.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're quite there yet.
I would imagine it even comes after a few thematic reviews into some of the different sections first.
So I think guidance, additional guidance, I think soft phasing in, and then you can see why they would stay away from operational services and golden copy data.
Fantastic. Moving on to the next one, or the last ones for the time being, is RTS 27 is an example where the industry has not achieved its goal for client transparency. How do you see this reporting evolve to achieve, and what it set out?
Well, it's not really the industry's goal, it's the regulator's goal. Nevertheless, I mean, RTS 27 is very well intended, but there are definitely some flaws in the design which make implementation difficult. The time delays in particular, so if you're looking in fast markets, which update almost instantaneously, sub-second, receiving data on a quarterly basis is kind of pointless. So I think it definitely needs some fundamental redesigns, probably some tailoring to particular asset classes, as Martin suggested, particular execution protocols as well. I hope to see a bit more work in progress.
So I'm just going to move into the final question to all the panelists, and this, and we can start with Nick and then move over to the others as well. So has your approach to regulation changed post-MiFID II? So we'll just start with Nick.
Yeah, I mean, in spite of my demeanour, I'm actually quite optimistic about the whole thing. really, I look at two big changes that we had internally. First was an exercise to start gathering all of this data, and that took in, first of all, the creation of a sales trader workflow. I think it was mentioned earlier. And for a lot of our markets, that's frankly revolutionary. Countries like, as I mentioned, so South Africa, Oman, it was really something that had not really happened before. So that's been a dramatic change. The second is it allowed us to try to impose a fairly common standard across all of our jurisdictions, particularly best execution, because if you're offering to provide best execution from, say, a branch in Singapore, then to suggest that the subsidiary in Hong Kong doesn't provide it is fairly spurious as far as a client is concerned. So to an organisation such as ours, it's a great excuse to standardise your business, to go to some of those different jurisdictions and say, we need everyone to come up to this level playing field. You start gathering fantastic data, both on your own activity and your client's activity, and over time you'll put that to much, much better use.
Martin?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a regulated entity, so as a solution provider, I mean, you see the harmonization. I mean, a lot of clients doing MiFID work in Asia and in the US, because everybody executes also here. So we saw some sort of widening, so it's a projection of the EU regulation to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm.
Over to you, Peter. Any thoughts on that?
So likewise, I'm not a regulated entity. So let me comment on the industry as a whole. I think it's been fascinating to watch, actually, but it's been a very bold attempt to be very specific around how data is actually sort of served up to the market. And I think it's got a lot of firms thinking quite hard. So if you go and talk to, for example, an interdealer broker around their MTFs and OTFs and the reference data that they are now actually sort of putting in place for something like that, which previously they would never have had thought about, then I think you're starting to see more structure in the market. It's clearly taking a long time to bed down, there's no doubt, and ESMA may sort of regret the fact that they've got themselves into sort of an operational sort of situation. But I think it's a good indicator of how things might actually play out in the future. I think if you look to the future, regulation might be much more about sort of sending well-structured, complete data to regulators who then process it in many different ways depending on what they want to do. And that may be the best way of actually aligning regulatory reporting across the globe. And so, I mean, actually, I think it might lead to something quite interesting downstream.
Malavika?
I think, likewise, we're not a regulated entity, but certainly if we... we recently actually ran a series of consultations with industry, and it was interesting to see the feedback that came from industry and a variety of market participants over the two and a half month period. And given that we sit specifically in the OTC derivative space, that's really all I'm able to comment on with any meaningful clarity. The things that people are telling us they want more of, you've obviously got one set of institutions that want as little as possible because of the overhead costs. Mm-hmm. There are, however, a variety of other categories of institutions that are asking us to look at, again, from an efficiency perspective, look at introducing hierarchies in the ISIN. Mm-hmm. So make it more meaningful, because today we have the ISIN and the CFI. There's then a question of, you know, do you go up or down from that? How do you make, if people are having had to spend money on this, how can you facilitate their efficiency so they don't have to rebuild something for another set of data points? The other thing that people are coming to us for are voluntary use cases. So again, a little bit building on that point of, what is my product coverage? What are you offering? How do we improve that? How do we take that deeper? And not just as products evolve, but also just from a portfolio coverage perspective. People want the choice of figuring out what to do with their data, to the point that Nick was making earlier. If you have to do it, you may as well get some efficiencies from it and benefit from the overall structure that's being put in place. And then the last piece is really this, we're just seeing a phenomenal growth in demand for just collaboration. The level of dialogue in the last 3 or 4 months has just been skyrocketing, which I think from where we stand is good.
Thank you very much, Malavika, on that. So I'll just take, in the interest of time, I'm just going to be taking the last question, if that's okay, over here in the sliders, is what would you say to investment firms that are buried in ARM or the APNX due to the external factors such as quality and availability of reference data?
Hang on in there, it will get better. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the reality of where we are, right? And it's partly because the data's not yet at the quality level that we need it to be, but I think these services are starting to bed down, and it will get better.
Thank you for listening to our podcast on sustainable MiFID II compliance. For more content on RegTech and data management from A-Team Group, visit our website at datamanagementreview.com. You can also sign up on the website for our next RegTech Summit, which will be in New York City on the 15th of November and is free of charge for financial institutions.